The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of obedience to God.
The issue of leadership as it regards obedience to God is our topic this morning. We've talked about a number of categories from the Leadership Bible: character, commitment, courage, and risk-taking, dependence on God, humility, integrity, and then qualifications for a leader. And one of those personal development qualities of leadership in Scripture is clearly that of obedience. And it is a struggle. It's an issue. We learn to obey God in the things we don't like to do. A child doesn't learn obedience by commanding him to go and go to the store and get an ice cream cone. You learn obedience by being told to do things you don't want to do, making up your bed and those kinds of things. And ultimately, in that process, we find that there's a lot of issues that relate to trust and the issue of knowing God and whether His commands are really good for us in the long run, and how we wrestle with that issue again and again, and often want to negotiate or redefine God's commands. And we're going to be seeing here a story in 1 Samuel 15 about a man who sought to do that, who sought to take God's commands under advisement and then modified them and then rationalized that change so that there was a spirit of rebellion involved in that. King Saul was told by God to go and destroy the Amalekites, and in doing so, he was told not to leave anything, including the spoils of war. And in the process of doing that, he attacked the Amalekites, but he decided to spare the king, Agag, and also to spare all that was good, the best of the sheep and cattle and so forth. And everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed, it says in 1 Samuel 15, verse 9. When the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I'm grieved that I've made Saul king because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, "Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor." You see there, there's an insecurity about this man, and he wants honor in the sight of men. And his fundamental flaw was that. He was more concerned about gaining honor and prestige in the eyes of men than in pleasing God. That was his particular flaw. You can look at every major biblical character and you can discern a fundamental flaw. Moses was that of anger. There are different issues that you have in flaws in certain people's lives. But he's gone up there, and when Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions." What's intriguing here is he was convinced when he saw the prophet that he had actually carried out God's instructions. So he was happy to see the prophet. He was convinced of that. He'd literally modified that according to what he felt was suitable. Because after all, what you have here, by sparing the king, you have a defeated king to gloat over. And you also have an expanded wealth through owning animals, which was of course at that time a contemporary wealth indicator. And so he redefined that and figured, "I did the main job, therefore I have obeyed God." Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" In other words, have you really obeyed God's instructions? If you had, you wouldn't have left any spoils of war. Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites." Notice what he's doing here. He's saying the soldiers brought them. Sorry, really, what could I have done about that? "And they spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." It's always fascinating in Scripture, people's rationalization of their disobedience. I suppose the worst one was the one that Aaron did when, you recall, when Moses went up onto the mountain to get the law. And the people became rebellious and so forth and wanted to have some idol to be made in the image of Yahweh so that they could actually have some image to worship. Because Moses, as for this man Moses, we don't know where he's gone. And so Aaron told the people to take off their earrings and their jewels, and he took the gold and put it into a fire and melted it and shaped it with a graving tool into an image of a golden calf. And here he said, this is your God, worship this God. And you recall when Moses comes down from the mountain and he sees this nonsense, he comes to Aaron and says, "How did this happen? What where did this thing come from? He says, you know the people, they're wayward, they're rebellious, they're disobedient. So I took some gold, threw it in the fire, out came this calf. He actually says that. I couldn't believe it. He's almost saying, what could I have done? The calf came out. The idea is so utterly preposterous, and then I think about my own excuses.
Sure.
And they're not any better. It's just when someone else hears it, you just see how inane, how absurd it is. So he just says, you know, the people brought these things. And Samuel said, stop. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Tell me, Saul replied. Samuel said, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you have wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? And then what's Saul's response? But I did obey the Lord, Saul said. I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. So he's redefined the command. The soldiers, again he's blaming them, took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. All of a sudden he changes that now. I don't believe he had any intention of sacrificing them, but, you know, it's like this the little boy who was talking about how he killed this rat, chased it all over the house, and finally cornered the thing and then stomped him, and he was describing how I stomped him real, real good and wiped that thing out. And then he noticed the preacher was visiting and said, and the Lord took him home. So, you know, this hypocrisy that we have, that we suddenly change our posture depending upon who we see is there. Samuel replied, does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. A very insightful word, this. And to heed is better than the fat of rams. It would be better for you not to offer a proper ritual than for you to do a ritual with a rebellious heart. It is not externalism that pleases God. It's the internal attitude of the heart. So you can get into all kinds of religious activities and still be totally rebellious against God, which is a basic theme. People are inveterate religionists, but relationship may often be another matter. He says, for rebellion is like the sin of divination and arrogance, like the evil of idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. So it's a very strong word there, where he rationalized. And the issue that we always have come down to was, what is my price? Do I have a price? When people are in positions of any kind of influence or power, they often have opportunities. And some are positive and some are negative. Some people have opportunities such as access to information or financial resources that they could use for their personal advantage. So we look at the situation at Enron, at WorldCom, at Xerox. We look at even Martha Stewart. We look at all these situations here where people have access to power, to money, to information, and who can be tempted to use that for their own aggrandizement and gain, and have the illusion that somehow they'll, in the long run, get away with it. I mean, it's an irrational kind of mindset in the long run. They suppose you're going to cover up a $3 billion cover-up. That's not an easy thing to do. The reality is that money, sex, and power are always going to be lures in our lives. You can just count on it. It'll always be those three, a combination or one in particular as a focal point. But all of us will be pulled each day by the lures of money, sex, or power. It may be the temptation, for example, when we travel widely and almost anonymously, to compromise our purity in such situations. Or it might be when we are tempted to compromise our integrity by using our position to unethically trounce the competition, whether internal or external. The fact is that we have constant temptations in our lives. And the question we have to ask ourselves in advance is, what would be the price? In other words, would I be willing to compromise if the price were right? We often would like to flatter ourselves to think otherwise. I've often seen some cynical literature and films about this idea that everybody has a price. Has anyone seen something like that or read a book about that? The idea that everybody has a price, including even religious people. people, even clergymen, they have a price. You can almost get cynical when you look at this. I play a kind of a game. It's kind of an odd game with certain people. I just did it with Heather yesterday. I actually try to quantify revulsion by asking him, how much would it cost, how much would I have to pay you to eat this? Heather and I were eating yesterday at the Horseradish Grill, and they served me trout. And the head was on there, and I said, it just occurred to me, hey, Heather, because she doesn't like fish anyway, how much would it cost for you to eat this trout head here? Her first question, are the eyes still in it? We're talking millions here. But I got her down to a half, about 500,000. Then you can keep on working on that sort of a thing. But quantifying revulsion is an amusing thing. But you know, I never play that game when it comes to compromising integrity or character. I'll do it with silly things, you know. How much would I have to pay you to wear this outfit? And if you're clever with the game, you always ask specific questions so you can really quantify this thing, you see. But the point is, it's not a game to play when you're dealing with something that relates to immorality. You can draw your line there. And the question is there, do we have a price? How much would I have to pay you to do something? It's fun when it's something that's morally neutral. But when it becomes something that actually could be a compromise in your integrity and character, there's the scary thing. Is there a price? And I would like to think that we're men who cannot be purchased, whose integrity can't be purchased. And yet, sadly, it's not uncommon for people who are followers of Jesus to cheat on tax returns and other things and on padding expense reports as much as the next guy. So then, are we saying then that for a few bucks they've compromised their integrity? You see my point here. The issue of questioning where do you draw your line and what price integrity and character comes in, and it always comes down to obedience. I'd like us to look at another text. By the way, let me stress this. God isn't interested in what we have. He's interested in us. He doesn't want ours. He wants us. Because if he has us, he has ours. And so the idea here is that our commitment to God hopefully would be non-negotiable. I want to talk about the habitual disobedience of Israel, though. And the problem that they had was that this was ultimately the cause of their misery and downfall during the times of the judges and then later the kings and during the time of the prophets. It was a habitual process that led to their misery and downfall. Deuteronomy chapter 10 is an intriguing text because there it gives the actual reasons, God gives the reasons for why he asked the people to obey him. He reduces his requirements to a distilled essence in Deuteronomy 10:12. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today, and here's the phrase I want you to notice, for your own good. God doesn't just give us a bunch of commands just because he's interested in telling us stuff to do. He gives us these commands for our own good, and that is the thing that we often may overlook. I would say, by the way, to fear him, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve him, all those are facets, really, of one thing, and that is a growing personal relationship with him. And one of the things that we're going to stress here is that there's a connection between knowing God and obeying him. The better you know him, the more you'll trust him. And trust and obedience are integrally bound together, and trust relates to knowledge. So if you cannot really trust someone that you haven't proved or known, but the more that you know that person and find that he's trustworthy, then the more you're willing to obey him. I will say that this obedience that flows out of trust then is always going to be related to a spiritual conflict, because our natural disposition is always going to be to trust in the visible rather than what we can't see. That's just the way it is. You're going to be more inclined to focus on what you see than what you don't see. And thus there's going to be this pull in your life. Notice the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel. Out of 42 kings, it was only nine of whom it was said they did that which was right in the sight of God. And even out of those nine, only about three really finished well. many of them even compromised at the end. It's rather sad to see that process where many of them dropped out of the race and began to lose the cutting edge of trust and obedience. But the issue that we have to ask ourselves is whether we really believe that everything God commands us to do is for our good or not. It was Eugene Peterson in a book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, which I like the title very much. He described how he had an experience with his lawnmower, and he had it tipped on its side, and he was trying to get the blade off so he could sharpen the blade. And he was working very hard, and he took his biggest wrench and couldn't budge that nut. So then he got a piece of pipe and stuck it in the end of the wrench so he had more leverage, and he was really working on this thing. And after many minutes of this struggle, he was getting emotionally involved with his this process here, doing everything he could do, leaning on that thing. So he took a large rock and began to knock on that thing, and all this to no avail. After a long battle with this, his neighbor heard the noise and came over, and he said, "You know, I used to have a lawnmower like that, and if I recall, the nut goes the other way. It's threaded the other way." Sure enough, he bangs it one time the other way, and it comes loose. I would suggest that many times when we're disobeying God, we're like him with that lawnmower. We're saying, "I want it to do it this way." Bang, bang, bang. And God quietly says, "Child, it wasn't designed to go that way. After all, I'm the architect of life. I ought to know how things are supposed to work. I've actually given you a blueprint for this life, the thing we call life." I've often heard people say, "Life would be so much easier if we were given an instruction manual, you know." Well, we have been. And we've been given a manual by the Maker. And the fact is, if we are wise, problem is, it often goes counter to our culture and counter to our intuition. And therefore, it takes a matter of risk to obey him, because after all, how do I know he's right? Even though you've got a history of proving it, you still are tempted to disobey him. I'd like to turn us to another passage that amplifies these themes of obedience. The next one would be in 1 John chapter 5. And it's one little verse that's very insightful. 1 John 5. By the way, while you're turning to that, Kelly Talamo tells what I think is a kind of a clever story about the plague. You recall when Pharaoh brought Moses before him again because of this, the next plague. This one happened to be the frogs. Remember the frogs? It was like raining frogs. They were everywhere. They were in their kneading bowls, you know. They were in their ovens, frog bread. You couldn't get rid of them. They were in the bedrooms. They were everywhere. And so he says, okay, you can go and sacrifice. Just get rid of these frogs." And Moses said, "Good. When do you want me to get rid of them?" He says, "Tomorrow." And Kelly says, "Tomorrow." And he's right. He says, "Another night with the frogs." I like that. Why would a man say tomorrow? How about now? I think I want to spend another night with the frogs before we get rid of them. You see, and we are, I think that's telling about us. You know, give me chastity, Augustine says, but not yet. This sort of deal here where we want to put it off, maybe then tomorrow. We often have this silly notion, too, that somehow we'll get real religious and spiritual when we are a little older, you know, then we'll have time to get into those things. The folly of that is to suppose that will be the case, because you see, you will become the person you are now. The habits of now, of today, are going to shape the person you'll be then. And habitual disobedience now, what makes you suppose you'll suddenly have this big turn when you're older? You'll just become more foolish and settled and set in your ways, and finally rebellious. And there's that scary point of no return that men can make. Only God knows the heart, but it's a frightening thought that a man can reach the point where he hardens his heart so much that God then starts hardening it for him. And that's exactly what happened with Pharaoh. So you have this reality here that we need to deal with. I would invite you to look at 1 John 5:3, when it says, "This is love for God, to obey his commands, and his commandments are not burdensome." He talks about everyone who is born of God overcomes the world. The victory that has overcome the world is our faith. I would say that that little word, "his commandments are not burdensome," is a significant word. The reason why they're not burdensome is, frankly, they're consistently beneficial, because obedience to God's will eventually leads to divine blessing. I think I can state categorically that in the long run, disobedience to God always produces more pain than obedience to God. In the long run, disobedience to God always leads in the long run to more pain than obedience. And I think that's ironic, because usually the reason why we disobey God is why? Because we think obedience will be more painful. We think it's more painful because we have our own desires. Do you see the struggle? Have you ever had that experience where you're trying to rationalize a disobedient act? And what we typically will imagine or fantasize about is what we perceive to be the benefits, but we're not really very realistic in our fantasy world. We're not really looking at the real world and what its true consequences would be. Furthermore, really, we have a history that tells us about this. May I ask you this question? Have you ever regretted an act of obedience to God? Let me ask you that question. Anybody? Have you ever regretted an act of obedience to God? Anybody? Have you ever come to regret acts of disobedience to God? You see where I'm going here. We can all pretty well say that we have a track record, that we look back in the past, and I don't believe any of us have regretted the times when we've trusted Him enough to obey Him. We may not have enjoyed it at the time, because frankly, it was to go against our flesh and sometimes to deny ourselves to embrace what He wanted. But in the long run, as we look back, we said, you know, that was the way to go. That was the best way to go. And so when I'm tempted to disobey God, there's this pull here. You see, do I really believe that God is loving, and do I really believe that God is sovereign? That's what it comes down to. If God is loving, what does that imply about His commands? They're going to be beneficial. If God is sovereign, what does that imply about His will? It'll prevail, and He can pull off what He promises. So if we understand that, then, that God is good and sovereign, then we can realize that He is a worthy object of trust, and besides which, He's proven that in our past. First of all, He's proven it in history, in the reality of His love for us. In this is love, not that we love God, but that God loved us and sent His Son to be a satisfaction for our sin. You see, God reveals, He demonstrates His love in that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. So He demonstrates His love for us in very tangible ways in Christ. And now, and then in our lives, He demonstrates His love for us in our history that we develop. So the real key issue here is to connect that with our love for God and our response to Him. Jesus said, if you love Me, what will you do? If you love Me, what would be the natural product of that? You will obey what I command, John 14:15. If you love Me, prove it, manifest it. If anyone loves Me, Jesus went on to say in John 14:23-24, if anyone loves Me, he will obey My teaching. My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love Me will not obey My teaching. So clearly, obedience flows out of love for God and leads to greater intimacy with Him. Obedience flows out of love for God, and actually, I would argue, then enhances love for God. So that actually what happens is the attitude and the action begin to reinforce. So then as you come to love Him more, then your capacity to obey Him at the next interval will be even greater. And so you have this upward spiral, which is in contrast to the downward spiral of small acts of compromise and disobedience, which can actually diminish your love for God, and so that can spiral downwards. We're either spiraling up more up or down. There's this process of, where we're moving in this direction. So I have to ask myself this question is, to what degree are my choices, and we've discussed this many times, you have three options in terms of the choices you make. A, to make them based upon right thinking, which is a biblical worldview. B, to make them based upon wrong thinking, a temporal view of the world. Or C, to make choices based on emotions, which is the subjective tensions in your life. Only one of them is going to lead to consistently good choices, and that's going to be biblical thinking, right thinking. If you make it on wrong thinking, which is rationalization or denial or any number of things like Saul, or if you make them based upon being led around by the nose of your feelings here, just moving around here, those choices will not serve us well. But God wants me to be happy, doesn't he? I've heard on several occasions of men who've been ready to abandon relationships and of commitment because they said, after all, God wants me to be happy. Actually, I don't find that in here. I find in here he wants you to be holy. He wants you to be like Christ. Now, I believe that that leads to happiness. But I don't believe the quest for happiness leads to holiness. But I think the quest for holiness will lead in the long run to happiness. But you don't look for it for itself. It's a byproduct of pursuing him more than anything else. Next text. Let's go to Daniel. The old story you all know about. The three in the furnace. What are their names? You remember them from some of you from Sunday school days. Shadrach, Meshach, and a lot of kids remember that. To bed we go. Yeah, Abednego. You recall the story. I need only remind you of their response to the king before they were going, and you gave them one last opportunity to compromise themselves, one last chance. The world will often give you numerous opportunities to renege on your commitments to God. And so in verses 16 to 18, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, because this was, by the way, you recall it, because they refused to worship the image that had been set up in his name. If we're thrown into this blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. If they'd stopped there, what would have been the problem with that? They're saying, we're trusting that God's going to rescue us from this. But then the question is that a biblical promise? I think a lot of times we can pin our hopes to things God never promised. The promises of God really relate to his character, and there are going to be times when we don't know what the outcome will be. Sometimes he'll rescue you, like he did in Hebrews 11. A lot of those characters were rescued. Others were not delivered, but all were waiting to receive the promises in the next life. In this case, they go on to say, but even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you've set up. Now, I think this is significant here. There are some commands that are obvious, so obvious to us that it makes good sense for us to follow. It'd just be stupid not to do them. But there are lots of others, though, that can require more discipline, more commitment, more accountability, some intentional decisions, some maintenance. And when those particularly are when you're backed into a corner, when it's crunch time, and it comes down to this, obey God and lose this deal. Obey God and kill the chance for a promotion. Ever have an experience like that? Just compromise in this area. These guys was bigger than that. Obey God and lose your life was the issue. And ultimately, the issue at that level, obedience at that level, will not require warm fuzzies and good feelings toward God and stuff like that. It'll require a clear conviction where you think out and really, again, we've talked about convictions before, and I believe Gail, didn't he talk a little bit about convictions when he was with you here, Gail Jackson? He and others define convictions as a thought-out resolution. These are thought-out resolutions between yourself and God that govern your behavior. You think them out in advance, because if you don't have convictions, and then you are in a time of temptation, your convictions will be moving targets. So you want to do is think it through before the situation. Try to discern what will be the pull. What are my convictions? Do I have a price? Where do I draw the line? Who am I trusting in the long run? Those are issues we have to deal with and wrestle with all the time. So in my view, their story of these men who trusted themselves entirely and faced the fire and has inspired many people who face fire both literally and figuratively, to let their courage work into our lives. And finally, I would turn us to Matthew 26, the supreme word about obedience. It is the word from Christ in Gethsemane. In Matthew 26:39, just prior to his arrest, going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me." But then those powerful words that transform human history. What are those words? Yet not as I will, but as you will. The precise opposite, really, of the compromise of the first Adam. So the first Adam was in a garden when he fell and said, my will, not your will, and turn that garden into a desert. The second Adam was also in a garden at his moment of temptation, and he turned that garden into the entry to paradise because of the choice that he made to trust in God. As I see it then, the issue here, it's called the Gethsemane mindset. Vernon Ground calls this the Gethsemane mindset. By this we mean it's the renunciation of our own human feelings, desires, hopes, dreams, and ambitions so that God's purposes may be accomplished. By the way, I never see in the Gospels an appeal to denying yourself that's not also accompanied by an appeal to greater gain. You see, God knows that we are desire profit. He says, I understand you. I made you that way. Just make sure what you go for won't let you down. Make sure that what you pursue is worthy of the pursuit. Don't sell yourself cheaply for baubles that will burn, but rather embrace that which will endure forever. Don't change the rules of the game as well. I mean, imagine, you know, you see in the back of newspapers these chess problems. White to mate in 3 moves, and then you try to figure out how is he going to be able to mate in 3 moves. Well, you know, and you could have the board set in front of you. I could figure out an easy way to do it. I could take the queen and put her in a place where the king can't avoid her. Yeah, you know, I can do that. But now are we playing the game of chess? You see, a lot of people decide, I'm going to redefine the game of life. It's no longer going to be as I see it. I'm going to just put my queen anywhere I want. Like my sister, when she would play with my father, she would always go to the bank. Whenever she was in trouble, he allowed her to go to the bank and turn pieces into other things that they were. Of course, he got a kick out of that because whenever she would start to get too strong, then he'd have a new chess problem to solve. And so he allowed that. But again, we're not talking about the same game anymore when you redefine the rules. I'm suggesting here that there is a glorious purpose to which we have been called, that the path to the glorious purpose, in my view, can only be achieved through this steadfast willingness to trust God in spite of appearances to the contrary. And here's a very real tension. Somehow God transcends those boundaries of time and is sovereign over history and sees the beginning from the end, but still, at the same time, he can be very, very involved in the process of human beings and in that. So you have that interface, that mysterious interface between God's sovereignty and then humans' choices. And somehow it pleases him when we obey him, just like it grieves him when we disobey him. Now, I can't make full sense out of that, to be honest with you. It's a deep mystery. But the fundamental mystery is the mystery of human freedom that has been given, responsibility, that God somehow has ordained the world in such a way that his plan isn't the same as his desires. He's very much involved. This is not some chess-playing God in the distance, but rather one who's intimately involved.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.